Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. Taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible, Christian faith, we'd be glad to talk to you. Right now our lines are full, but that doesn't mean it's hopeless if you're not one of the calls waiting on the switchboard and you hope to get in today. There's a very good chance you may. And so I'm going to give you the number. And you'll just have to call in a little later in the hour, and you may just find a line has opened up. So if you have the number ready and you call, you know, randomly throughout the hour, you may catch a line open. It happens every day. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. I received a letter from a new listener just today, calling from Alaska. Not calling, but writing from Alaska. She says she tries to call in, but the number hasn't worked for her. I don't know why that is, but anyway, she asked if I'd answer her question. And so I will. Now, she had heard someone told her that the Bible said a certain thing, and she's trying to quote it from memory. And I think she's not quoting it quite the way it's often stated, although the way it is often stated is, for the most part, not biblical. I'm trying to read her handwriting's not too bad, but it looks like, yeah, she's got a question mark in the middle of the quote. It's better to question mark at something something when than into the belly of a whore. Now, I know what she's referring to because I've heard people quote this before. It's not a Bible verse, but the way people often quote it is, it's better to cast your seed on the ground than into the belly of a whore. And I think people have used that to say it's better to go to a prostitute than to masturbate or something like that. I mean, I'm not sure what they're trying to prove by that alleged quote from the Bible. There is no such quote in the Bible. However, I do know where it comes from. It comes from the story of Tamar and Judah. In Genesis 38, where one of Judah's sons, who had an obligation under the customs of the time to father a child for his in the name of his dead brother. So I can't get into the custom right now. It's called the law of Levirate marriage. It's also found in the law of Moses later on, but this is before the law of Moses, much more ancient custom. One of Judah's sons was required by custom to father a child by the widow of his brother who had died childless. And he didn't want to do it. And so he practiced one of the most, I guess, ancient forms of birth control. And that was, he practiced withdrawal. So it says he spilled his seed on the ground. Now, he didn't get killed by God for that. Well, no, he did get killed by God, excuse me. But his brother, Judah, the father of the boy, later had a sexual relationship with the same woman, thinking her to be a prostitute, and she got pregnant by him, and he suffered no consequences. So it's an old story. It's confusing to us with our modern ideas and understanding of things, but basically, this woman had a husband who would not father a child with her, and he withdrew and spilled his seed on the ground. Whereas Judah later, thinking her to be a prostitute because she was in disguise, did have sex with her and had a son and didn't suffer. So I think this is where somebody formulated a proverb. It's better to cast your seed on the ground, or excuse me, it's better to go cast your seed into the belly of a whore than to cast it on the ground. So this is, it's not a biblical quote. It's not a, yeah, Onan is the son who did this, Jude's son. Anyway, if you're interested in the story, it's in Genesis 38, but it doesn't really have that statement, and it doesn't teach that principle. Although someone could say, well, you know, God punished the one guy, and he didn't punish the other guy, and so he must have thought this one thing was better than another. That's not the lesson of the story, and it's not even a lesson, I think, that can be deduced from it. But that is, I've heard people quote that, as if, you know, they quote it sort of like they quote, cleanliness is next to godliness, or God helps those who help themselves, and they somehow think this is in the Bible. It is not. But the story is in the Bible, It's just that the proverb that they've gained from it is not a biblical line, and it certainly is not a valid conclusion from the story. All right, let's take a call from David in Eugene, Oregon. David, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. My question today comes from two passages. One of them in Genesis 2, where we see Adam, and God determined that he needed a suitable helper. So, of course, he formed Eve out of Adam, and they had companionship. And then we go to Mark 12, and the Sadducees give a scenario where a woman was married seven times because her husbands keep dying. And then they want to know who will be married to her at the resurrection. And then Jesus replies, "Are you not in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God? When the dead rise, they will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels." And so my question is, do we totally rule out companionship with the opposite sex at the resurrection? Or could it just be that we won't be married in the traditional sense?
It's interesting that you'd bring that particular case up in Mark 12, since we had just been talking about another case involving the practice of levirate marriage. The Sadducees came to Jesus, and the Sadducees did not believe in the doctrine of the resurrection, and Jesus did. And they were trying to trick him, and they said because of the law of levirate marriage, there was the obligation of seven brothers in a row to try to father a child for their deceased brothers with the same woman. And so seven men were her legal husband during her lifetime. And they all died, of course, as people do, and so did she. And so they say, now, if there's a resurrection, which one of them is going to have her? She's been legally married to all seven. And this situation was even required by the law. So, you know, God set this up, that this woman would have had seven husbands in this circumstance. And so which of the husbands is going to get her in the resurrection? And the answer was none, because there won't be marriage in the resurrection. Now, your question is, how has that changed from Genesis 2, where God said it's not good for man to be alone? You know, I'm going to make a helper for him. Now, if it's not good for man to be alone, why would it be good in the resurrection for man to be unmarried? Now, I would suggest a slightly different take on Genesis 2. A lot of people say that when God said it's not good for a man to be alone, and then he made a woman and created a marriage, that when God said it's not good for man to be alone, he said it's not good for man to be alone because he's lonely and he needs companionship. Well, that's not the whole problem. It is true, man does need companionship. But marriage was not created strictly so that man could have companionship and nothing else, because God could have made another man to give him companionship, or a whole group of men, or a whole group of men and women. Or, you know, a pet that he enjoyed to be a great friend and companion. So, I mean, obviously, creating a woman is not the only way to resolve a problem of loneliness, if that's the problem. The problem was, it's not good for a man to be alone if he's supposed to fill the earth with his seed. And that's what God made Adam to do, is to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now, it's not, if a man's got that as his assignment, that's what God's will is for him, it's not good for him to be alone because he can't do that. You know, he needed not only a companion, he needed a companion of a certain sort that corresponds to him in just the right way to make it possible to have children and be fruitful and multiply. So God didn't just make another man or a group of people or find some animal that made a great companion like a Labrador Retriever, but he gave a woman who, of course, satisfied the need for companionship, although, frankly, the need for companionship was never mentioned. To say it's not good for man to be alone, we would say, well, I don't like being alone because I'm lonely. But God didn't say that's why. He just said, I mean, there's other reasons it's not good to be alone. For example, in Ecclesiastes, he says if a man is alone and a man attacks him, he might be defeated. But if there's two, if he has a companion, they can defeat him. In other words, there's lots of reasons to have companions besides the fact that you're lonely. And in this case, God made woman because there needed to be an earthly population generated from this relationship. Now, in the resurrection, that need will not exist because everybody who's ever been saved will be in the resurrection. The world will be well populated. There won't be a need to repopulate the earth by childbearing. So the institution of marriage apparently is not necessary. But will there still be special relationships, as you said, between men and women and so forth? I don't know what that'll look like. I don't know if in the resurrection people will all be, as it were, asexual. That's certainly a theory that many Christians hold, because Jesus spoke of them being like the angels, and they don't marry. And therefore, one would perhaps conclude that the angels and maybe resurrected people too might be asexual or not. You know, he didn't say they'll be asexual. He just said they won't marry. So there may be still gendral differences for some reason, if there's value in them. But they won't be for the purpose of procreation and or sex. And so if there is any kind of pairing going on, it will not be the analog to marriage in this order that we live under. We might have many special friends, but not in a sexual relationship in a society. In fact, there's single people today who have lots of relationships with people of the opposite sex, but they're not sexual relationships. And so in the resurrection, there doesn't have to be marriage in order for there to be companionship and friendship and, fulfillment and things like that. True, if there's not sex, many people today find a hard time imagining how that could be fulfilling to have a relationships with no sex. But frankly, we're going to be different in the resurrection than we are now. Mm-hmm. even in this life, people at different ages or stages of development have more or less interest in sex. I mean, a 4-year-old doesn't have any interest in sex, and most 10-year-olds don't. A man who's in his 90s might not. But there are different stages of life where different desires are more prominent. And it seems obvious that if there's no marriage in the resurrection, that'll be a stage of life for us all where, sexual relationship is not what we're seeking.
Yes. Wow. Thank you. That was very, very, very helpful. I appreciate that.
Okay, David. Good talking to you. Thanks for your call. Okay, our next caller is Gary from Ohio. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. Yeah, hey. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Great. Yeah, I have two things. First, I have a ministry I'd like to bring to your attention. I have a short question. Yeah, over the past months, I've heard a lot of people call in asking for good ministries to donate to. And, my son did some good research about a year ago relating to that. You know, we were both hoping to find a ministry that does a great job getting the biggest bang for the buck for God's kingdom. And we found a ministry and been donated by a year. It's called Doulos Partners. It's spelled Doulos. Partners.
Mm-hmm.
And we were impressed by these quick little items here. First of all, they have no administrative costs. The costs
That's
are covered
good.
By the board of directors.
Excellent.
Two, they very diligently seek out indigenous ministry organizations. They're very efficient at evangelizing at a low cost. They're ranked as one of the most efficient ministries by ROI Ministries, Return
That's
on Investment
good.
Ministries at audits. And then, in 2019, Doulos Partners spent about 91 cents per conversion and $290 per church planted. Also, we have met the president, his wife, and they're very, very humble Christians. And the website is doulospartners.org. Again, Doulos, partners.org.
Yes, that's the Greek word for slave. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. And then the question is a very short question. I was wondering if you could speak to how the Christian life should mostly live in the will and not the emotions.
Well, yeah, definitely. I think any Christian life or any other sane life has got to be lived out in the will and not in the emotions, because the will is the means by which we say yes or no to certain options. Now, if we were to live out of our emotions, and in other words, if we didn't use our will to say no to any emotions because the emotions trumped our will, then we'd be living erratic lives because our emotions go up and down and all over the place, and we feel emotional bonds for people. I mean, think of how the institution of marriage would fare if we decided whether to stay married or not merely by our emotions. Now, you know, we stay married because we made a commitment to do so, and we choose by our will to keep that commitment. Every commitment we make, it's our will that decides day by day to be faithful to that commitment. But if our emotions were running the show, well, some days we'd be glad to be married. Some days we'd kind of wish we weren't married. Some days we'd be glad to be married to the spouse we're with, and maybe other days we'd wish to be with other spouses or none. I mean, there's just some days we'd take care of our kids. Sometimes we just wouldn't because we wouldn't feel like it. The will is where rational life is governed. And emotions provide incentives, sometimes to do the wrong thing and sometimes to do the right thing. I mean, if your emotions make you deeply in love with your wife, well, that's a good thing. But if your emotions start to drift and start to be in love with your neighbor's wife, well, then those are bad emotions. Same emotional experience, but directed wrongly in one place and right in another. So the will is necessary for the purpose of discerning between good emotions and bad emotions, frankly, and which ones we should affirm and which ones we should say no to. So certainly the Christian life, but not only the Christian life, all responsible life, even among non-Christians, is lived out of the will, not the emotions. Now, I realize that we live at a time where people don't even think clearly about such things, and their assumption is, without questioning, that whatever they feel strongly about, they should do. If it feels good, do it. You know, if I emotionally am, unhappy where I am, I should go somewhere else and do something else. Even if doing so means I'm breaking some promises and neglecting responsibilities. That's the immature, irrational mentality of a great number of people in our day, and it's affirmed very strongly by the culture in some sectors. And that's where the Christian life, as you say, may differ from ordinary life eventually, because there will be an awful lot of people who do just leave their spouses because they feel like it, or they do just kill somebody because they feel like it, or they do just, scream and shout when somebody is saying something they don't like because they feel like screaming and shouting. They don't know how to act like adults. There is already a fair amount of that going on in places you would never have thought it would go on, often on university campuses. But frankly, if a significant portion of the population becomes infantile in this way, then yes, we might say it is almost a distinctly Christian value to live out of your will rather than your emotions. But at this point, even those who are not Christians, who have a sense of maturity and responsibility, do not live for their emotions. Our emotions help us to help us either to enjoy the choices we make, or to hurt for them. But they don't determine whether the choices we made are right or wrong. Those are decided by principles, not emotions.
You know, one thing I was going to say, it seems like a lot of the Christian music, I'm kind of an older guy like you are, and it seems like the songs today are meant to stir your emotions. And as they're doing that in the worship service, the people are told that you're experiencing God right now, that these emotions are God. And
well, I agree. That is happening. That is happening in some places, and it's not a good development.
Gotcha. Okay, great. Well, thanks for your answer, Steve. Really appreciate it.
All right, Gary. God bless you, too. Thanks for your call. All right, our next caller is Jim from, I guess it's Montero, California. Monterey, I'm sorry, the call screener didn't write it right. Okay, Monterey. Good to hear from you, Jim.
Hello, Steve?
Oh, hi, Jim.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there's a very loud buzz on your line. What kind of a phone are you on?
Landline.
Well, that's not a very good connection, I'm afraid. It might be good for you to call back, because sometimes you'll get a better connection the second time, because the noise is louder than your voice.
It's about as good as it's going to get. It's the old 1980s Princess-type phone, where I'm at here.
Well, are you in a hospital?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you, there's noise. The whole audience is enduring the noise. I could hang up and say call on a better phone, but I think if you can state your question real quickly, then we can hang up and I can start to answer it.
Okay. My problem is I'm not going to be able to hear what you say.
Oh, you can't listen to the program.
I don't have radio or online access.
Okay. I'll tell you what, Jim. Listen, we can't have a long conversation with this kind of noise on there, so I'm going to ask you to call back, and you just might connect to a better, might get a better connection, because this is not acceptable for radio. All right? Call back, and we'll take another call in the meantime. Scott from Fort Wayne, Indiana, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
So my question is out of Matthew 13. A couple of verses in particular, Jesus gives a series of parables, and then he goes in a house in verse 36, Matthew 13:36. He says he left the crowd, went in a house, and his disciples were asking him for an explanation, and he explains one of the parables there, the wheat and the tares. And then he gives a couple more parables, and then it gets to the point where I get stuck. After these additional parables about the hidden treasure, the costly pearl, and a dragnet, then he says this in Matthew 13, verses 51 and 52. And so I assume that he's talking just to his disciples in the house.
Right.
He says, Have you understood all these things? They said to him, yes. And Jesus said to them, therefore, every scribe who has become a disciple of the kingdom of heaven is like a head of a household who brings out of his treasure things new and old. So I'm confused by the reference to a scribe. And then what does this mean about bringing out of his treasure things new and old?
Okay, well, a scribe, of course, was an expert in the law in the Jewish faith. So they were the ones who did the research. They were generally of the Pharisee party rather than the Sadducee party. And they were devout students. They're sometimes called lawyers in the New Testament. They were the ones who studied the law of Moses and were expert in it. So this is, some of them had become disciples. And Jesus said, wow, these guys had treasures from the Old Testament that they could offer, but they also have now the new treasures that they've learned when they're instructed in the kingdom of God. So now, were some of these scribes in the room with him? Possibly. You're right. It does say in verse 36 that he went into a house and his disciples came to him. But, of course, his disciples refers to more than simply the 12. I mean, there were lots of disciples following Jesus around. He had crowds of disciples sometimes. On occasion, many of his disciples left him. But there were times when the Bible speaks about a multitude of disciples being with him. So we don't know how many were there besides the 12. There could have been some there who were disciples who had been scribes before they followed Jesus. And he could have been speaking about people who were not present, or he might have been speaking about people who were there among the disciples, saying any scribe, you know, who has become a disciple and been instructed in the kingdom of God, he's got a lot of wealth there. He's got the wealth of the knowledge of the kingdom, but he even has the wealth of the knowledge of the Old Testament, which most people didn't. Because people didn't have their own Bibles, you know, they didn't have printing presses back then. So the average person didn't know more about the law than they'd hear on a Sabbath read, maybe a chapter or something like that once a week. And but a scribe would study the law all the time. So he'd be somebody who knew a lot. And I think it'd be comparable to somebody who had been raised in a Christian home and had been taught the Bible well before their conversion. You know, they got converted maybe as a young adult, but they'd spent years exposed to the Bible and conditioned by biblical family training and so forth. Then they become a Christian. They've got a lot more to offer in a sense. I remember a friend of mine who was an apprentice under an older pastor, and he's hoping to be a pastor. He said to the older pastor, you know, how old a Christian or how young a Christian would you allow, if it were your choice, to become a pastor? And the older man said, I think maybe a minimum of 5 years old in the faith. But he said maybe a little shorter if he'd been raised in a Christian home, been raised a Christian to be a Christian. And because, see, some people are raised in Christian homes, but they're not really converted. But they're picking up the Christian ideas and culture and so forth, so that when they do get converted, those things are a foundation in their life upon which their new learning can build. Whereas someone who comes out of a pagan background, doesn't have a Christian background at all, and gets saved, well, they can, of course, learn pretty much as much as anyone else, but they don't have that foundation to start with. It takes them longer. And I think Jesus is saying the same thing about scribes in the Jewish religion, which was the true religion before Jesus came along. Anyway, that's what I believe he's saying, that a person who was a scribe, an expert in the law, once they become a disciple of Jesus, they've got not only, you know, the truth that they learned from Jesus, they have the truth they learned before they knew Jesus, too, and it's good truth. So that they have treasures, old and new, that they can bring forth, assuming if they're teaching. So I think that's what it means. I appreciate your call. I hope that helps. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have another half hour coming up. At this point, we just take a break to tell you that the Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do so from the website, thenarrowpath.com. Everything's free, but you can donate from thenarrowpath.com if you wish. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour, taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you might want to give us a call. We can talk about it here. We have a half hour together left. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. You know, in our first half hour, we got a call from Jim in Monterey, who had a really bad connection and it not good enough to continue his call. So I told him to call back, and he has done so. So we're going to talk to Jim right now. Oh, Jim, your connection's still bad. That is a terrible phone line.
I think I know what's causing the problem. They put in a new TV for my roommate, and I think the
it's interfering with your phone line. That could be right.
From his TV interfered with my phone line.
Okay, well, I'm inclined to say we can't take the call, but I know you're in the hospital, and you've got limits to how what phone service you can use, so I'm going to ask my callers to endure this for a moment. We can't talk for very long, though, Jim. What is your question?
What I wanted to get at, and I'll try to be quick about it, is what is your understanding of Ezekiel 37, 38, 39? Has that been fulfilled, or is it yet to be fulfilled?
All right. Yeah, my opinion is that they have been fulfilled. Ezekiel 37 is the vision of the dry bones, and then they assemble in the vision and into living bodies, and then they become alive, and so forth. And God explains to Ezekiel that these bones represent the discouraged Israelites or Jews who are scattered throughout Babylon because they've been taken into captivity into Babylon. And their nation has been destroyed. The Babylonians burned down Jerusalem, burned down the temple. There's nothing really much there anymore. So they're like dead. It's like the nation of Israel's dead. They're like scattered dry bones. And he said, son of man, Ezekiel, these dry bones are the whole house of Judah. They say our bones are dried. We have no hope. Our hope is gone. But in the vision, the bones do assemble back into bodies and come back to life. And he says, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to restore them. I'm going to reassemble them, and I'm going to bring them back to their land. And, of course, that's what he did in the days of Cyrus the Persian, There was a decree that allowed all those Jews who had been scattered in Babylon, who were still living, were allowed to go back to their land, and Israel was reestablished from death. It's like it rose from the dead in a way, because there's no nation there for 50 years or more, and then there was then it restored. So that's what that vision is about. Now, when you come to the next chapter, chapter 38 and 39, it's one extended prophecy about Gog and Magog. And it says that, you know, once that God has restored the people back to their land, there's going to be some aggressive power that is going to come against them. And it says that an evil thought comes into the heart of Gog, saying, you know, let's go up to the land of unwalled villages and to the people who've recently been brought back from captivity. So it's clear that this invasion takes place shortly after, or at least not too very long after, Israel has come back from the Babylonian exile. So they come back from the Babylonian exile in chapter 37. And then in 38, sometime while their exile is still in living memory, because Gog says, you know, those people who've just come back from captivity, he's going to invade them. And then, of course, the story is told in very apocalyptic imagery. You know, the Gog comes down with this great horde, and they're all on horseback. They're all carrying bows and arrows and armor and helmets and shields and things like that. And, you know, they're invading Israel. They're trying to destroy Israel. And fire and brimstone come down from heaven and consumes 5/6 of the armies. And then it takes like 7 months to bury the dead and 7 years to burn the weapons of the invading force. And so because of the apocalyptic imagery here, you know, fire and brimstone coming from heaven, for example, or taking 7 years to burn the weapons and 7 months to bury the bodies, it's very commonly thought, oh, that, you know, certainly nothing like that has ever happened in history, so that must be a future war. Now, it's only the fact that these apocalyptic things in this imagery can't really be said to have literally happened in the past that would make us think that this is a future thing at all. There's no reason to think it's a future thing, since it's placed shortly after the Jews have returned from Babylon, which would naturally make us assume that this happened sometime before even the birth of Christ. They returned from Babylon in 538 BC or 539, and there were powerful forces that tried to destroy Israel at the time, and God did deliver them. Now, he didn't deliver them with literal fire and brimstone coming out of the sky, but in apocalyptic imagery, the prophets and even the book of Revelation that speak about, you know, fire and brimstone coming down from the sky, they're borrowing that imagery from Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah and the flood were two instances in which God supernaturally destroyed wicked societies, and the imagery, especially of Sodom and Gomorrah, is taken up a number of times in other places, like the story of Gog and Magog. It's also taken up a number of times in Revelation, and some other prophets once in a while talk about fire and brimstone. This idea, it represents God's overwhelming judgment. True, in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, it was literally fire and brimstone coming down, but in the imagery of the apocalyptic writings, it's simply speaking of the destruction of the bad guys in terms that say that in principle it's very much like the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's not really literally the same kind of destruction with fire and brimstone, but that's how they talk about it, because it's a destruction from God. And likewise, you know, the battle is talked about as an ancient battle. They're riding horses, they're wearing, you know, armor, have shields, bows and arrows, spears. There's no modern battle ever fought or going to be fought with such weaponry as that. So I think that apart from the apocalyptic imagery that confuses people unfamiliar with it, everything about it suggests an ancient battle. Now, I don't know which one it is, but between the time that the Jews came back from Babylon in 538 BC and the time that Jesus came, there were two major crises that the Jews faced that threatened their extinction. And one of them was in the time of Esther, when Haman, you know, actually had gotten permission from the Persian king to exterminate the Jews. And there is a danger of that actually happening throughout the whole Persian Empire. And that included the Jews back in Jerusalem, because they were part of the Persian Empire too. They were a vassal state under the Persians. So the entire Jewish race could have been exterminated if Haman's plan had been carried out. But the book of Esther tells us how that was thwarted, and it definitely indicates that God, although it doesn't mention God, it mentions his providence very clearly, bringing about the deliverance of the people so that the Jews today celebrate it to this day with the Feast of Purim. They're commemorating that deliverance. And that happened, 500 or 400 and something years before Christ. And therefore, it was after the Jews had returned. So it might be that crisis that is symbolically described in Ezekiel 38 and 39. There was another one, too, later, around 186. I'm getting all my tongue tied. 168 B.C., and I know, Jim, you know about this because you know history very well. But in 168 B.C., the desecration of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes, a Persian tyrant, he tried to exterminate the Jews and their religion. And God delivered them through a very small guerrilla band that was very much outclassed. I mean, a little bit like, Russia outclasses the Ukraine militarily. That's kind of how it was when God delivered the Jews from the plots of Antiochus, who had all the armies, a nation of armies, and the Jews were fighting with just a really ragtag force of guerrilla guys hanging out in the woods in the mountains and coming down and raiding the Syrians. And so God delivered them from that. And the Jews to this day celebrate that too. And, of course, that's what Hanukkah is about, how God delivered them at that time. They still celebrate. So both the crisis in the time of Esther and the crisis in the time of the Maccabees, which was Antiochus Epiphanes' threat of Israel, both of those came after the return of the exiles from Babylon, but before the time of Christ. They both happened in, I guess we could call it, the intertestamental period. And both of them are commemorated by the Jews as amazing and wonderful divine deliverances. And so it's possible that one of those two could be represented with the symbolic descriptions of Gog and Magog. Now, obviously, I'm sure, Jim, again, you're very well informed. I'm sure you know that many Christians believe that the Battle of Gog and Magog is a future battle, and that Gog and Magog refers to Russia and its confederates in some modern or future battle. And I just don't see it. I just don't see it. The time frame of Ezekiel places it after the return of the exiles from Babylon. The battle is ancient. The battle is described, as I said, in ancient terms. Now, somebody who would apply it to a future battle would say, oh, well, the horses, the bows and arrows, the spears and all that stuff, those are just symbolic for modern weaponry. Well, wait a minute. Then you're talking about symbolism here, right? So you're not taking the passage literally. You're taking it symbolically. So why would you take that symbolically, but you wouldn't take, for example, the fire and brimstone from heaven as symbolic? You know, you've got to take something symbolically. If it's an ancient battle, you've got to take symbolically things like the fire and brimstone from heaven, the burning of the weapons for 7 years, the burying of the dead for 7 months. If it's a past battle, those things are not literal. But if it's a future battle, then the weaponry is not literal. In other words, nobody, whether they think it's a future or a past battle, takes the thing literally. They've got to take it symbolically. And in my opinion, the imagery of fire and brimstone from heaven and the number 7 months, 7 years are very typical of apocalyptic symbolism. And so I think it's more likely that it's an ancient battle and that the features that make us think of it as eschatological are part of the apocalyptic imagery that's used. So that's my understanding of that section of Scripture, Jim. I appreciate your call. I'm sorry to have to cut you off because of the noise on your line. Okay, Daryl from Sacramento, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hey.
I have a question about, is there any qualifications for an evangelist in the Bible?
You know, the Bible doesn't give any qualifications for someone being an evangelist. We do have clearly qualifications given for being a bishop or an elder by Paul. in 1 Timothy 3 and in Titus 1. Also, 1 Timothy 3 gives qualifications for being a deacon. There are qualifications for being an apostle, certainly, at least an apostle of the type that Paul was, and that was that they had to have seen Christ and had him commission them specifically in that role. So some of the ministries in the New Testament would have special qualifications identified. But a couple of things, it doesn't say what their qualifications are. One would be an evangelist. Another would be a prophet. Another would be a pastor or teacher. When Paul lists these different ministries in Ephesians 4:11, he says he gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. He doesn't mention the elders, but I think they are the pastors. So, I mean, he is talking about that. So I guess we could say there is a qualification for a pastor, but not necessarily for a teacher. Usually the pastors and the teachers were the same, and they were the elders. But obviously, the old yarn that says, what do you have to know to train a dog? And the answer is you have to know more than the dog. I guess to be a teacher, you just have to know more than the people you're teaching. In fact, I've been teaching since I was 16, and I didn't know much when I started, but I knew more than the people I was teaching. So, I mean, that's just, I guess you have to know something, and you have to know it well enough to teach it profitably and with God's anointing and so forth. Now, as far as evangelism goes, an evangelist, I suppose, since the word evangelist means one who preaches the gospel, an evangelist should be somebody who knows what the gospel is and has a gift of God in communicating it effectively. There's certainly nothing like a college degree or anything like that that's necessary. And even though nothing is mentioned in the Bible about the character of an evangelist per se, I think it would be assumed that anyone who stands up and represents Christ before people should have at least as good a character as, one who does so in some other ministry. As if you're standing before unbelievers preaching the gospel, you should be as blameless a person, I would suppose, as if you're a minister standing up in front of a congregation. And we know that there's pretty strict character requirements for an elder, one who would teach the church. I would think that it'd be certainly desirable for somebody who is an evangelist to have that kind of character too. The main difference is that an elder is expected to be a very mature Christian, whereas a person who's an evangelist might not have an awful lot of theological knowledge or have been Christian for very long. I'm thinking the first evangelists that were ever sent to preach the gospel are the women at the tomb of Jesus when he rose from the dead. And the message they preached, just like the message of our gospel, is that Jesus is risen from the dead. And they preached it to the apostles. So the first evangelists were women. Now, Paul didn't have women in the role of elder, but an angel commissioned women to the role of evangelist. Now, they had just learned that moment that Jesus had risen from the dead. So the message they were preaching is one that was totally new to them, which means they weren't long-standing Christians with a lot of training. They knew something that had to be told to others, and that was that Jesus had risen from the dead, and they were commissioned to go and tell it. And that would make them evangelists. At least, I should say, that would make them involved in evangelism. And the reason I made that distinction is that not everyone involved in evangelism is necessarily holds an office of evangelist, and not everyone who prophesies is a prophet, not everyone who teaches is a teacher. We know that because the Bible indicates that everybody could prophesy, everybody could evangelize, and everybody could teach, but not all are evangelists, not all are pastors, not all are teachers, and so forth. So I would say, if you ask what's the qualifications for an evangelist, I would think the evangelist should be, at the very least, a good example of a Christian. That is their character should not bring reproach upon the message they're preaching. And that hasn't always been the case with evangelists, I have to say. There's been some evangelists who preached well, but their character was, really brought a reproach on Christ. I think that anyone who stands and publicly represents Christ in any ministry should be somebody whose character is perhaps as good as it can be, better than the average, Christians, so that person is an example of Christ as well as a spokesman for Christ.
Do you think that David lost his spirit when he committed adultery and murder
Your phone broke up. Did you say something? Did you say, did David lose the spirit when he committed adultery and murder?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I don't think so because he repented. Remember, when he repented of those crimes, he wrote Psalm 51, in which he included this prayer, "Do not take your Holy Spirit from me." So he assumed, and this is actually after he had committed the crimes and after he had repented, and there was a bit of an interval between those two, because he didn't actually repent until he was confronted about it by Nathan the prophet. I don't know if it was days or what, months, but there was some interval during which he had committed that crime and he had not yet repented. But after he repented, he wrote as if he still had God's anointing, but he feared that it might be taken from him. And there's every reason to fear that, because Saul, like David, Saul had previously been anointed by the Holy Spirit when he was made king, and so was David. But when Saul was rejected by God, God took his spirit from him and sent an evil spirit in his place, and that's when the spirit came on David to replace Saul. So now David has done evil, and he's praying that God will not reject him as he did Saul, not take his spirit from him, but he certainly is praying as if he is not aware of it having happened. And there I'd have to say that the spirit was not taken from him before he repented. And if not before, then probably not after either.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Okay, Darrell. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Let's see. Brandon from Hawaii. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, aloha, Steve.
Hi. Aloha. Hey,
real quick, I got two questions. Matthew 13, the last caller, or the couple of callers ago, he talked about the kingdom of heaven is like a net. And to me, it says at the end of the age. I just want to know, am I reading that properly? But it looks like to me it's referencing the catching away, where the good are gathered into a net, and the wicked, of course, are cast away. And the angel, he says, so it will be at the end of the age. So is that a reference to the last days? And then also, I wanted to ask, I seem to make some connection to Malachi 3, where it says that there's a book of remembrance that will be written for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on his name. And he says, they will be mine. I will spare them as a man spares his own son. It kind of looks like, and I don't have my Bible with me. I hope I'm right on those scriptures. But do you see some connection there? And is that what it's talking about?
Well, it depends on what the end of the age is. We have two parables that have kind of the same ending. One is the dragnet parable you mentioned. The other is the wheat and the tares, and they are very similar to each other when Jesus gives the explanation. Because, for example, at the end of the parable of the wheat and the tares, he says in verse 40, Matthew 13, 40, therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so will it be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and who practice lawlessness, and they'll cast them into a furnace of fire. Now, later on, when he gives the parable of the dragnet, it ends kind of the same way. It says in verse 49, so it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth, separate the wicked from among the just, and cast them into a furnace of fire. So, and then both passages, verse 42 and verse 40, or verse 50, say, and there'll be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Now the question is, what is the end of the age here? I think almost everyone tends to assume it's the end of the present age, the end of the world, you know, the church age, when Jesus comes back at the end of the world. There are some who believe that he's talking about the end of the Jewish age. And that age ended, of course, in the first century when Jesus brought the new covenant, and then the temple and all those things associated with the old temple age were destroyed in AD 70. And so there are people who would say that the end of the age here refers to AD 70, in which case it would not be perhaps what you're thinking or asking about. It would be talking about something that occurred in the past. I personally, although I do see AD 70 as significant in many prophecies, including many of the parables, I have my reasons, and I've written a book about this that'll be coming out real soon, so I won't go into detail now because we're almost out of time. I think it's talking about the end of the church age. I think it's the end of this present age, and therefore I think it is when Jesus comes back. Now, Malachi said, as you said, in chapter 3, that God will God is aware of those who fear the Lord and who speak often of him, and their name is written in his book, and they'll be mine, he said, in the day that I gather my jewels. Now, I personally think that in the context of Malachi 3 and 4, is talking about 70 A.D. And the reason I say that is because Malachi 3 begins with the coming of John the Baptist and of Jesus at the beginning of this age, and it also ends with the coming of, chapter 4 ends with the coming of John the Baptist, who's described figuratively as Elijah. But Jesus said, if you can receive it, John the Baptist is Elijah who is to come. So I believe that Malachi 3 and 4 is talking about the first century. And it does talk, at the beginning of chapter 4, is a day is coming which will burn like an oven, and all the wicked will be burned, and so forth. And I think that is talking about the judgment of A.D. 70 upon the wicked, the apostate in Jerusalem, which were certainly burned up by the Romans. But in that context, he knew those that feared his name. He knew the faithful remnant. And there was a book of remembrance written, and they were in it, and he indicated he's going to spare them at that time. Well, the church at that time was spared. Even the Christians in Jerusalem, when it was in danger, they fled and escaped from Jerusalem and were not destroyed. God did spare his people. And that included the living disciples at the time. And Jesus had said to his disciples, for example, in Luke 10, do not rejoice that the demons are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven, which I think might well be a reference to Malachi 3, that the disciples of the first century, followers of Christ, they were in the book of remembrance. They were the ones who feared the Lord, who spoke often to one another, and they were the ones that he rescued from that Holocaust that occurred in AD 70. So I'm not thinking Malachi is talking about the same thing as Matthew 13, though there would be a group of people who would agree with you, and that would be those who think that the end of the age mentioned in Matthew 13 and in those two parables, the end of the age, that is the end of the Jewish age, which would be 70 A.D. Therefore, they would say, yeah, Malachi is talking about 70 A.D., and so is Jesus, so that they'd see it the same. But if you're thinking of the end of the age in Matthew 13 as the end of the world when Jesus comes back, and that's how I'm looking at it, then I would not make it the same event as Malachi 3. Though I could be wrong, because things like that, different people have different opinions about. And where there's more than one opinion, there's always a possibility that mine is wrong. All right, we don't have much time left. We might have a minute or so. Sandy from Gig Harbor, Washington, can you use a minute, or is that too short a time?
Yeah, that's just right. I just have this verse, Luke 12, 54 to 56, and I ask if that's, could it, I know it probably means 70 A.D. In the Jewish age, but could it be where Jesus is warning us to see current events as kingdom events too?
Well, that's a good question, because this is where Jesus talks about recognizing signs of the times. And many preachers think that we're supposed to be looking for the signs of the times now. But if you read the passage, Luke 12, verses 54 through 56, you'll see that he's saying that the Pharisees should recognize the signs of the times, meaning the times they were living in. They obviously wouldn't recognize the signs of our times, because the signs of our times were not happening then. So he doesn't actually speak of the signs of the end times so much as the signs of the beginning of the Messianic age they had been looking for. They'd been looking for the Messiah, and he was there, but they weren't recognizing him, and so he's rebuking them for not recognizing the signs of the times they were living in. I'm sorry I'm out of time. It's only an hour, and it does go by very quickly. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Once again, we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us out, go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and you can see how to donate and how to take things for free, which is what we do. We give things away free. Thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.